So next up, our last speaker before the coffee break is Professor Derek McCauley. So he's going to talk to us about computation cloud, which is an area that's received a lot of interest and attention lately. And I was reading Derek's biography, and he's had a lot of experience kind of across the whole gamut of computer science, from computer architecture all the way through to a number of startup companies and activities with Microsoft and Intel. So without further ado, I will turn you over to him for the last talk before the break. Thank you.
Thanks very much. I'm not sure who made up the title for this talk, actually. It feels like it's been machine translated from the Chinese. I'm going to highlight actually some of the opportunities I see in big data, and then start to point out where we're actually allowing computational limits to get in the way, and the architectures we design for the data flow. We heard earlier about statisticians just trying to go on and process the data, but I'd like to present the idea that actually the architecture that we use critically dictates which statistics we might actually want to research and understand. So what am I going to do? Right, so we've both chosen, Al and myself, to use the Wikipedia definition. It's always, big data, it's this new and exciting thing, and the one that really annoys the crap out of me is, big data proponents say, the sample set is now everything. I say, no, it's not. I mean, there's always more data out there. It's all down to how much can you actually gather. So this myth of we have all the data, therefore we don't have to do sampling. And we heard earlier on about the challenges of sampling in data sets like Twitter, where some very noisy people, it's called the Justin Bieber black hole. If you want to derail a Twitter conversation, all you have to do is insult Justin Bieber, use his handle, and 5 million of his fans will spam that hashtag. Okay? So you're very easy to get, to actually pollute the data as well. So of course, being an old person, I like to think, have we seen this before? Well, actually, yes. 1880 was the first big data problem. They couldn't do the US Census. Actually, I was privileged to have the head of the US Census give a talk at a meeting recently on social media analytics. We had a workshop, and he gave me a talk and talked about the challenges that they still had. In fact, the National Library of Congress has had the Twitter feed, all of it, for the last 4 years, and they still do not know how to release it for people to use and get access to that data. Not least because they're actually ethically challenged, and something I'd like to point out to a colleague from Dunhumby. There's certainly plenty of companies I've talked to, two very respectable companies in Nottingham, Boots and Experian, and they're very wary about what they will do with the data for fear that the customers will get very, very angry very quickly. Most Twitter users, for example, don't expect to be quoted out of context. If you suddenly present them with their Twitter, what they've tweeted back to them and say, is this what you're on about? They can actually get quite upset. So big data is not a new problem. It's always just a slightly bigger problem when we have the technology to deal with. And of course, as scientists, we've traditionally attacked this problem because we live for data. So we build bigger machines to record more data. And then we challenge ourselves to be able to process that. But I think it's important to look at what we've learned from things like CERN over the years. 20 years ago, when I was doing computer networking, which is what I used to do, CERN were very active in the networking community. They were building network switches. They were deploying real state-of-the-art stuff. And the only way they could deal with the deluge of data was triage in the network. They would basically take the data in and say, that is not these are not the particles we're looking for. Ditch the data. Okay? There's a tendency at the moment to presume that big data is all about, first of all, we must gather all the data together in one place, and we shall call that place Hadoop. Or we shall put it all in the cloud. And once we have it all in the cloud, then everything will be rosy. I'm going to take you down a path that explains why that's not true. And many of the big data examples we've had for many years that are often cited as, these are the classic big data problems. One of the things we've been doing is throwing away most of the data very rapidly because it's really boring. The Internet of Things is going to produce phenomenal amounts of boring data. The temperature sensor in my house will register monotonously 21 degrees during the day, and then slowly crawl up to 22 degrees during the evening, and then drop down to about 20 degrees overnight. And it will do that every day. And what am I going to do? Stream this data every half second to some cloud service? It's nonsensical. So as we heard earlier, one of the things we want to look for is anomalies. What are the statistics of the data we want? And the mean is not usually the interesting statistic. So the one thing that I'll give big data that is new, it's not just big, it's the stuff that we heard earlier about machine learning. Although, again, I happened to work at Intel at the time that we applied machine learning techniques to the equipment in the fabs. Fabs, where we build the chips, are very expensive. They cost about $4 or $5 billion to build a fab. And the yield of the chips is very important to the profitability of the company. So we started looking at the data coming out of these machines and said, let us apply machine learning to this, especially as we had copy exactly. We had two fabs, exactly the same configuration in different places on the planet, allegedly producing the same chips. And you look for process variation. And even before that, when I was at Microsoft, we hired a bunch of machine learning people, the man who wrote the book, Chris Bishop, and various others. So those techniques, those machine learning techniques, which of course date back to what, Vapnik 76 or something? Okay, it's not that new. Those techniques are now just coming to the fore. Right? And everyone's excited because we've now got these very low cost devices everywhere with all the sensors in it, entirely correct. And here's one person who makes sure that very few applications get access to any of that sensor data. And they certainly don't get my clickstream. We have some major issues to deal with here as we start to move into this space. So we've heard it already, and I just want to, I don't need to emphasize this to this audience given what it is, but if I ever hear someone say again, we don't need to think about the sampling of our data, I'm going to scream because it just drives me mental. In fact, we did a submission to the Parliamentary Select Committee on social media data mining. They were wondering whether the government should do real-time analytics on the Twitter feed and Facebook. Well, you can do that, but you'll see a very skewed view of the world. Particularly, and this is where it sort of gets slightly serious for a moment, if you go to look at Twitter for criminal activity, what you will find is public disturbances. Oh, so-and-so has thrown a brick through the shop window. What you will not see is domestic violence. So should we assign our police resources based on what's happening on the Twitter feeds? Well, of course not. It's completely nonsense. But some of the ways in which the data gets the way in which it is misrepresentative of what's going on underneath is critical. And I'm sure you, more than I, know the classic example of predicting the election. And of course, it's interesting that Gallup screwed up the Obama election because they did it again. They sampled from people who had fixed phone lines. My kids don't have a fixed phone line. I'm not sure they ever will have a fixed phone line except to get internet access once they move out. So they missed a whole demographic. They missed the whole younger generation. They missed the Hispanics in America, and no wonder they got the wrong result. So even the people who you think know better, whose company was built on doing sensible sampling, managed to screw up. So there's still plenty of opportunities for getting it wrong. I used to have the Google flu example after that. I mean, it's a classic psychology experiment. Google flu worked as long as no one knew that's the experiment that was going on. As soon as you told everyone, then people were typing, what is this Google flu thing? And you got completely spurious answers. So it's a classic psychology experiment. Never tell the subject what the experiment is until after they've done the experiment. And then once they've done it, they can never do it again, because now they know what you're after. So I want to pick an example, because it's an interesting one. I'm going to go with energy monitoring. This is a little gizmo. In fact, the energy company gave one to me for free because it was asserted that if you install one of these in the house, you get between a 5 and 15% reduction in energy. And the government said, well, if that's the case, you can give them away and you meet your carbon reduction targets. Whoa. Now, actually, if you look at the data behind that, you find that the error margin of that is about 10%. It was such a small sample. It's appallingly bad. So, in fact, it's a pretty spurious use of statistics. Of course, politicians love that. Of course, there was no explanation of why or whether it was sustainable or anything else. In fact, would putting a piece of paper next to the door that said, have you switched the lights off, have had the same effect? What the hell's all this technology got to do with it? So we better probe It's one of the things that I'm very keen to understand, and it's one of my first challenges to in looking at big data when I work with my colleagues in maths at Nottingham, is I want to have some explainability about this. I don't want it to just be some correlation that says, oh, look, this happens and this happens. I'm not sure whether I've got the lemons and road accidents example today, but you know, spurious correlations, there's a whole website for it. When it comes to some of these things, we want some explainability out of it, and not just the magic of the statistics. We want some model that gets generated, actually explain what's going on. I mean, just in passing, I mean, the other amusing things about this is, this will display the units in kilowatts, or money, you can put in money, or it'll do it in tons of CO2. Does anyone here know what a ton of CO2 looks like? I mean, how big is it at atmospheric temperature? No, you see? So giving some of these units, giving the average consumer how many tons of CO2 they produced doesn't really make much sense. In fact, we've done psychology work on this and shown that money doesn't make much sense to them either. So I'm going to come at this from the point of view, I started off the research institute I run up in Nottingham. We set out to look at personal information, look at all the marvelous things we could do with personal information, but we did come with a privacy agenda that said, what current organizations are doing is applying brute force techniques to raw customer data. And in many cases, not Dunhumby, very sensible people, but in many cases, there are startups out there who are today, in my opinion, breaking the law. And they're certainly in violation of the Fundamental Charter of Human Rights that underpin all our data protection law. So let's look at this example. Here's an energy trace from one of my research assistants' house. This is a 7-day period along the bottom, and 24 hours zoomed in. Okay, so here we are, 8:30 in the morning, 3 kilowatts. What's going on?
Boiling kettle.
8.5 kilowatts at 9 o'clock. Having a shower. All right. What are all these other things? Fridges switching on and off. Oh, another cup of tea, or microwave oven or something. With very fine-grained data, you can actually do an enormous amount of useful stuff. For example, you can look at the mark space ratio on a fridge and freezer switching on, and you can tell how it's aging. Okay? You can do performance analysis of the behavior of the fridge and the freezer, and you could actually say to people, you know, it's time to replace that. I did this. I had one of these American fridge freezers. It unfortunately had a fan which pulled in air for ground level and blew it across the heat exchanger. I have 2 dogs. This fan had managed to hoover up all the dog hair in the kitchen and paste it across. So in fact, when I put a monitor in this, I noticed that the fridge was never off. And it was because of all this dog hair. So I cleared the dog hair out. And then it was on for about 75% of the time, off 25% of the time. I said, that can't be right. And looked at the manufacturer's product and said how much the annual energy consumption was and went, this is not right. And then I thought, it's 16 years old. It's had it. Did the calculation and said, I can buy a new fridge which will pay for itself in energy saving in 6 months. Now, you don't have to be a professor of computer science to do that, to figure that out. But on the other hand, the average person in their home is not going to spend their time figuring that out. And so this data is of enormous value. It's of enormous value to the individual. It's of enormous value to society in terms of saving energy and stuff like that, just looking at this energy data. So then we come to the issue of, well, is this the data that you want to share with anonymous people in the cloud who might use it for God knows what reason? So let's just look at this data again. 7 days, shower, 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 shower. Oh, no shower, no shower. Now, said research fellow is female, French, psychology. She comes into work, a rather cheeky PhD student, computer scientist, slightly spotty, says, I see you didn't have a shower this morning. Horrified. Now, that's the amusing side of it. In fact, it turns out that this particular trace is not, don't use that example here, but this is a different trace. This is a weekend. And in fact, the Dutch rejected smart meters rather brusquely a few years ago when they said, well, who the hell's looking at this data? This is a burglar's dream, especially as the security system involved was laughable. And you could basically monitor hundreds of homes for whether people were present or not by looking. And if you get this sort of data, you can start to see lights being switched on and off. So, oh my goodness, we shouldn't do that then. We should not do this. We should do something much simpler. What the UK has decided is that when we get smart meters, which is mandated by the EU, in the next few years, you will be required to give a reading once a month. So you can set up so it only reports once a month. You can, by default, it'll be set up, so you'll have to opt into that. It'll be set up as standard to report once a day. And you can opt in to once every half hour. Well, once every half hour, even once a day, still gets you to the, you can probably detect whether people are on holiday or not. But at this point, people are going, oh my goodness, we've lost all this enormous value in the data. Because now you're just giving us the integral over a half hour period. It's like, this is of no use. And somewhere along, and this is because it's all getting shipped up to the cloud so we can do this marvelous analytics on it. And somewhere someone's just lost the plot. This analysis of this data does not need to be done in the cloud. It's a completely independent and interesting data stream that should be processed where it is born, in the home. And this realization that people were saying, oh, we can't do these things anymore. Oh, why are we going to build a business on this data? It's like, well, don't even bother with that. Why don't you go back to what I refer to as the ancient 1990s Microsoft business model of, you ship me some software that does something useful, and I run it in the privacy of my own computer. Instead of the, I ship you all my data so that you can process it for God knows what, and you give this to me for free, Someone up there was using Gmail. My God. Can't understand anyone who uses Gmail. So that's the trade we've made here, is in order to get free stuff, we give the data for unspecified uses. And in a separate talk, I could go on about informed consent, the lack of informed consent, the whole fact that the whole digital economy is on a very precarious legal basis at the moment, but better not get into that, because that's too scary. So we'll just look at this problem. So we did some, you start doing some things with the data, and very rapidly you realize that that data at that level of every half hour or whatever, by itself, it's almost useless. You try to do any correlation with anything and you get nothing useful. So what we've started doing is saying, well, let's not just, this statistic, the time average over half an hour, is one of the more boring statistics. Why don't we look for motifs in the data and report that? So I can tell you, I can see when you've made a cup of tea. I can analyze the data, and those are the interesting statistics. How many times was the washing machine on? How many times? So actually, take the fine-grained data, process it in such a way that we get useful and meaningful statistics out of it, which we then aggregate and share. And here's the thing. When it comes to these privacy issues, one of the key things is that often the statistic is not very personally sensitive. Here's the big news. Who here knows what mosaic category they are in the Experian mosaic demographic? Anyone know? No, it's not something you particularly know. It's not. I've got an app though. It's on here. I'll read it out. Hilarious. So I'm a B5. Okay. B5. Here we go. Mid-career climbers. 40s and 50s. Yeah. Family, secondary school children, pleasant modern houses. Yeah, I built my own 17 years ago. Technical and organizational skills. I guess that's why I made me a director. Early adopters of new technology. Yeah, it's an iPhone 6. children's education is important. Competitive. Yeah, well, I didn't quite get where I am today without a bit of competitiveness. This statistic, I'm not particularly embarrassed that I'm a B5. That's not an embarrassing statistic. Most people would guess if they looked at this categorization. Now, if someone wanted to do this sort of categorization of me, and they were just some J-random startup, I would be a bit loath to give them all my financial transactions so they could do it. On the other hand, if they shipped me some software and it said, by the way, I'm going to say, I think you're a B5, are you cool with that? I go, yeah, I'm cool with that. You can have that data. So in processing the data and getting away from the raw data and moving it into a domain where we deal with some statistics, especially if we can remove some of the temporal issues, so we can talk about what's this household do on an average day. It consumes 5 cups of tea and it makes 3 meals and the washing machine runs 5 times because it gets 2 teenage boys who play football. Then that data is not so sensitive as the stuff that you can then start deducing all sorts of other things from. So yes, this leads to a slightly different terminology, and we heard it earlier as well. A lot of these big data problems are only big data problems because some fool decided to gather all the data together in one place. It was actually just a large number of instances of small data. Okay? And if one can process the small data where it is born and only share statistics, then you can perhaps think about solving that big data problem. You're still processing a hell of a lot of data. These phones process a hell of a lot of data every day, but not by moving it all to one place. And we came at this from the point of view of privacy. But then we noticed something. The smart meter world, there are two reasons they went for this only sampling every half an hour. One of them was the privacy issue. That could have been slightly fixed. Mosaic's now asking me for my location, okay? So abuse of. The way in which they try to get information out of you is insidious. One of the reasons was privacy, but another reason was who's paying for all the bandwidth? And we have an as yet unproven business case for services we will offer once we have all this data. So moving all this data costs money. So technology is cheap these days, but it's not zero. And so people say, oh, but it's cheap to do that. I'll give you an example right at the end about just thinking about what happens when you scale these things. Something marginal cost may be small, but if you multiply it by a very big number, you can suddenly get back to being serious amounts of money. So it's very easy to say, well, it's really cheap to do this per user. And if you're successful and have 100 million users, you're going to be doomed. So rather than think about this problem, I'm going to try and press this button. OK, yeah. So, you know, rather than starting with small data and aggregating it and then say, let's do some analysis on it, my challenge to the community, technical, computer science, and statistical, is what processing can we do on the data to get small statistics that we aggregate and get the same answer? And I'll take a proof that it's the same answer to within a certain statistical limit. Now, what is this a bold vision that I have that, you know, I've had some blinding insight here? Not really. the insight was given to me many years ago by Frank Kelly. So let's take a simple example. This room will be chock full of people who did A-level physics. Must be, right? So how would you solve this problem if I want to know the voltage at this node? Two laws. Kirchhoff's laws, right? That's your A-level physics answer, right? Now, what if I said you're not allowed to see any of, you're not allowed to have global knowledge. You're only allowed to see the one point in the network that you want to determine the voltage at. How are you going to solve the problem? No, people haven't seen this before. You haven't read my blog. You're going to apply Maxwell's equations and solve the dynamic problem. Much harder, 2 to 3 years more education. But it's the same answer, and for very good reason, because one's a steady state solution and one's just solving the dynamic problem. So it's harder. But this argument that says we must bring all the data together so we can analyze it, rather than we can partition it and analyze it separately and then converge, is just, in my opinion, an interesting problem waiting to be solved. And for people who can prove that they can take the data around that small statistics and aggregate, for privacy reasons and for performance reasons, you'll win. And here's the example that I was familiar with from my younger years. This is the routing algorithm that was used in the phone networks for many years, dating back to this paper's in 1988 from ITC, International Telecommunications Congress, Teletraffic Congress, by Frank Kelly, and proved that a switch in the telephone network can make a random independent decision on what to do when there's congestion, and proved that asymptotically you get the same optimal solution. You get towards the optimal solutions if you had global knowledge. Brilliant piece of work. And the really good news is that asymptotically tends to cause computer scientists to go, oh my god, how long do we have to wait? And the answer was, you get to the asymptote here, to within the amount of noise that's in the system for other reasons, when you get to like 50. Infinity's not very that far away in some of these cases. It's an absolutely beautiful result. And it leads me to this, you know, the continued vision that there's a lot of scope here for understanding how we analyze the data independently and then merge them together. We may need to bring the data all together to do our lab experiments, but when we come to deploy it, we need to figure out how to deploy it in a much more distributed fashion. We have a speaker from Rolls-Royce. I'm not going to dwell on this, but when this engine is in the air, it cannot report continuously from all its sensors back to HQ in Derby, because there just ain't that much bandwidth. But trust me, it's got a lot of sensors on here. So I won't use a Rolls-Royce example. I'm going to use this example, which is my current favorite. This thing moves 200 tons of rock at a time. It is composed of an enormous diesel engine just here and an electric generator. And each of the wheels is driven by an enormous electric motor, which are all controlled by transistors this big, right? Like megawatt transistors. I've never even seen these things until a year ago. And every one of these transistors is it's a switched mode power supply, right? It's just like your laptop. It's just a honking big thing. And every one of these is generating megabits per second of sensor data, every one of them. And there's many, many of them. This vehicle generates, and it's they're not autonomous, this vehicle generates many tens of gigabits per second of data. Someone turned up to a company that runs these vehicles and said, we're going to do big data for you. Ship all your data to this data center in North America. These vehicles operate thousands of miles from any civilization. And they're going, really? So the realization was, they're not throwing the data away. They're processing it in situ. They have to. But they are forced by the constraint. But there's a lot of problems like this. And one of the things that worries me is that we're actually passing up a lot of big data opportunities because we have this mental model that we have to put it all in the cloud. The cloud's very valuable. I had a startup. We did Zen. It was great. It was marvelous. Cloud, excellent. But it's not the answer to everything. My appeal is for people to think seriously about what statistics should you gather from your data, how should you get right to the front end of where the data is being captured and gather the salient information you need that will actually inform your big data analytics. And the argument is there's always more data. So understand what it is you need to aggregate. This idea that we will just gather all the data and then figure it out. It's like, well, I can just give you more data. I mean, that's simply a way for certain companies to sell more and more computers or more and more cloud services. Oh, just send us all your data. So determine the statistics with, you know, we need information content here. What's the algorithm we're going to run? And what is the source of the data that we actually want that algorithm to run on? And the raw data, your algorithm is distributed. At some point, you are processing the raw data. But the question is, when do you need to aggregate the data? CERN have been doing it for years. It's not new. And the other thing is that computation at the edge is cheap. I don't know, if the computer scientists in the room, you might appreciate it. But the ability of the ADSL modem, the humble ADSL modem, to do the signal processing it does in order to jam hundreds of megabits or tens of megabits down a pair of copper wires that was quoted for years as having a maximum capacity of 56 kilobits, because people band limited their thinking to 3.4 kilohertz. The signal processing, that's frightening. It's almost incomprehensible under processing. It's deployed in ADSL modem. Processing at the edge is cheap. Think about what advanced processing we can do at the edge. In fact, it's one of the things that Arm are interested in. Arm are very interested in what can they put in their new silicon can they build that does that statistics on the data as it's gathered so that it compresses it down and saves bandwidth. And the key thing that I want to finish with in big data is prepare for success. It's very easy to say, right, let's do this thing and apply some analytics to it and say, right, now we've got our business, we're going to get some value out of it, and the marginal cost of doing it is very small, so we're okay because it's okay. This is an example of success disaster, although they weathered it. Animoto, take pictures and a video and audio, and they make you a pop video. They animate the video. This is what I made with my dogs. And they released a Facebook app. And they went, this is the 13th of the 4th, 2008. This is the number of servers they were using. And then they released the Facebook app. They went from 4 servers to 4,000 servers in 3 days. So they went from a bill of $35 a day for computing resources to $35,000 a day. And thankfully, they had a business model that was positive cash flow. They took your credit card number, billed you before they actually hired the servers. Brilliant business model, guys. This stuff costs real money. So people say, just use the cloud, put it all up there, it'll be fine. Think about when this is successful and you've got millions of people and you're processing this data for millions of people, is that actually a cost-effective business model? It may look cheap because it only consumes 1% of CPU today. But if you start getting millions and millions of those people, then that's going to cost you money. better to get them to use their own processing grunt, sell them the app that does the analytics, and then merge the data. Okay, thanks very much.